This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Granite Staters continue to sift through the results of Tuesday's primary, including what the huge margins for Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders may mean for state politics this fall. Meanwhile, New Hampshire pollsters are happy, having predicted both races pretty accurately. Steve Cozella of MassInc Polling Group says that's no easy feat, especially when it came to the crowded GOP race.
This year, on the Republican side, even with a big, messy field, they were within 1 or 2 points of every single candidate, with one exception, which was Marco Rubio. They really did a very good job overall of predicting the final percent of each candidate, which is, I'd say, quite a remarkable thing.
And while many Granite Staters may not want to hear about politics for a while, this week New Hampshire's U.S. Senate race picked up steam with Republican Senator Kelly Ayotte calling on her Democratic rival, Governor Maggie Hassan, to sign a pledge against taking outside campaign money.
Since she's gotten into this Senate race, she has repeatedly railed against third-party special interest groups. And if she really is concerned about this, and this is not just a campaign talking point, I hope she'll do something about it and join me in signing the People's Pledge.
Ayotte spoke on WMUR-TV. The legislature was busy this week despite the primary, including a vote in favor of House Bill 1696, which establishes a new funding formula for Medicaid expansion. Joe LaChance, a Republican representative from Manchester, promoted the measure.
It has been my goal for sponsoring 1696 to find a way to continue the program in the New Hampshire tradition with no new taxes. We've done it.
Today in The Exchange, it's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, and let's hear from you. Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests are Gary Reno, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader, and Sunday News. Gary, thank you for being here.
Good to be here, Laura.
Also with us, Casey McDermott, digital and State House reporter with NHPR. Casey, welcome back. Thank you for being here.
Good morning.
And also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, welcome back. We've spent a lot of time together this week.
Yes, indeed. Happy to be back.
Well, and Dean, some soul searching in both parties here in the Granite State. What these enormous margins mean for Democrats and Republicans here. How about on the Democratic side, Dean? What does the, pardon the pun, huge victory for Bernie Sanders, a self-described Democratic socialist, mean for Democratic politicians here as they eye their own political futures?
Yeah, you know, and it was certainly a large margin. I don't think many of us predicted, although the polls were fairly accurate. I think a lot of us thought the race was going to close a little bit in the final days. You know, a 22-point margin and, you know, Bernie Sanders got something like 86% of the youth vote. He edged out Clinton overall with women. He cut into some of her margins in places like Manchester and Nashua, where you're more likely to see working-class Democrats who have been a part of her support. You know, I think it suggests, and we've talked about this before, that the Democratic Party in the state has moved to the left. As I've mentioned before, when I first moved here, it was almost over 20 years ago now, the party was considered much more centrist, and I remember someone telling me that to be a successful Democratic politician in New Hampshire, you needed to work well with Republicans. And so we had Gene Shaheen and John Lynch, and even to some extent Maggie Hassan, who were, you know, part of a more kind of centrist approach to Democratic governance that goes really back to the Clintons and the Democratic Leadership Council in the early 90s. So the party has certainly shifted to the left, not only here, but nationally. I mean, we've always had Democratic socialist politicians, at, you know, mayors, even, you know, representatives in Congress, but never doing this well at the presidential level. So this really signals, I think, a change. Part of it is simply kind of outsider politics and people rejecting the status quo. But part of it is kind of a sort of an ideologically ideological shift about the role of government and what government can accomplish. And it is pretty remarkable to see how it's changed in New Hampshire over the last 20 years.
So, Gary, if I'm a state senator or someone who has aspirations for the state Senate or the state House, or I want to run for executive council and I'm a Democrat, can I now start talking about, you know, income taxes, for example?
I wouldn't touch that one.
Really?
Well, that's still the third rail of New Hampshire politics.
Even given these shifts that Dean talks about.
Even given these shifts, I don't think taxes is part of this issue that we're seeing here.
And this is within the party. We're not talking about the state as a whole.
Right. I mean, this is a whole different ballgame we're talking about now. I mean, this is frustration from people. People are tired of the same people in the same – coming from the same middle of the ground running for the major office. And I think people – the progressive wing of the Democratic Party has always been there, and they needed an excuse to raise their head like they've done in the past. When they were a minority party, it was a little easier to do that. But when you're a majority, you kind of keep quiet and let the – things fall where they may. But now they have an excuse to get out there, and they get out there big time.
Well, so what about Republicans, Dean? What cues, if any, might state Republican candidates take from the impressive Trump victory here in the state?
Well, you know, there's been this internal debate within the party for some time about, you know, kind of movement conservatives versus establishment politicians. We've heard a lot of these phrases over the last couple months in New Hampshire. You know, Donald Trump also won by, you know, very large margins. He more than doubled John Kasich's second place finish. And I think, you know, he benefited from a fair number of independent voters. We're going to talk about turnout. This was a record for Republicans in the primary. So same sorts. It's interesting. You know, we heard lots of anecdotal stories about people trying to decide between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, which is not a pairing you might necessarily think of. But it does reflect, as Gary was saying, the sort of unhappiness with politics as usual is a phrase you often hear. So I think a lot of the things that were animating people to want to shake things up on the Republican side with Donald Trump, similar here on the Democratic side, although Trump, from an ideological perspective, is a little more complicated for a variety of reasons.
Did you want to jump in, Gary?
Sure. I think, you know, we always looked at the Republican Party in a lot of ways as being divided between the conservatives and the old traditional Republicans.
Yeah, that's not a new story.
That's not a new story. What's a new story is I think we got a three-way split now. We have the Trump element, the traditional Republicans, and then the conservative element there.
Well, he's picking up some of those conservatives, though, as well. I mean,
they're
split primarily between him and Ted Cruz, but he is getting some of those folks as well.
And this group that he's turned out are people who aren't particularly participating in a Republican Party in a real way.
Our phone number for you to join us on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup and the Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. And while we're talking about it, Exchange listeners, what do you think these impressive margins for Trump and Sanders mean for state politicians here in New Hampshire? Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org, 1-800-892-6477. And Casey McDermott, Dean touched on it, but I do want to hear more from you. Turnout, the latest seems to be that there was a record set on one side, not the other, Casey.
Right. So the turnout was pretty high on both sides, but did set a record on the Republican side. According to numbers reported by several news outlets, there were 277,445 votes on the Republican side and 243,143 votes on the Democratic side. And that fell short of a record in 2008, which was about 280,000 votes. But overall, there was, you know, pretty robust turnout all around.
Gary, did you want to jump in on that?
Sure. I think what's really interesting this time, and we'll find out a little bit more about that either the end of the week or early next week. But usually when you have same-day registration, mostly that's largely Democrats who are doing the same-day registration. But this time, from anecdotal evidence, talking to people, most of the same-day registration, or a good part of it, were Republicans turning out for Donald Trump.
That's interesting.
And so it's sort of like turned on its head. And at the same time, there's also a lot of people that I talked to who are at the polls said that the independents who came in, instead of taking Republican ballots, as everybody expected, a lot of them were taking Democratic ballots.
Was there any problem, Gary, at the polls this time around with voter ID laws? These are, you know, they've been put in place for a couple years, but there's still some sort of shaking out as to what's required and what people working at the polls need to do.
Well, I mean, there were some problems at the polls. Was it about because of that the voter ID law? Not necessarily, but there were some real problems, such as a huge traffic jam in Merrimack, where they had one way in and one way out, and it just backed up traffic from one end to the other.
Wow!
But I mean, there are. I mean, everybody expected it to be a bit of a hassle because it's going to be the first time for a lot of people, but it seemed to go fairly smoothly.
Again, our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. It's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup here on The Exchange. And guys, let's go to the phones. Chris joins us from Nashua. Hi, Chris. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you.
Go ahead.
I'm really intrigued by this difference between establishment and outsider. I don't really know what it means because, especially on the Republican side, when you look at the positions that the candidates are taking, for the most part, there's really not much of a difference. And so I don't really understand whether it's simply defined as an ideological purity test, as in, you know, somebody is willing to compromise in any way, and that makes them establishment, or is it really just a matter of labeling, positioning, image?
Tone,
presentation, wrapper. Like, I can't really figure out what it is they're even arguing about.
Well, wow, Chris, what a great question. And Dean, sounds like a whole show, really.
I mean,
we could dig into that for a long time, but go ahead.
That's a great question. It's true. And, you know, and one of the things that is sometimes frustrating for people as we, you know, as we watch these elections unfold is, you know, analysts and others throw a lot of kind of categories around because it helps you sort of wade through a lot of the noise out there in the political environment. And, you know, so we've talked a lot this time about lanes. A lot of people talked about, you know, an establishment lane and an outsider lane. And Donald Trump supposedly had his own lane. Or we can just talk simply about insiders versus outsiders or establishment. I think what I liked about Chris's comment was I do think a lot of it really is kind of about tone. It's about emotion. It's about whether you identify with the status quo or not. There are some differences on the issues. You know, the Clinton and Sanders have drawn pretty sharp distinctions on health care and the idea of moving to a single payer plan and how that would work. And on the Republican side, there's been some, you know, debate over immigration and Donald Trump's proposed a ban on Muslims entering the country. So there are some issue differences, but a lot of it is simply a way to define people who adopt a particular tone as candidates designed to kind of shake up the status quo. And some people, particularly people who are not kind of regularly involved in politics, often identify very strong with that. And there's always an element of kind of you hear words like anger and frustration, disruption. So it's a lot. Some of it's stylistic and I think some of it is policy.
Let's take another call. Thank you for that one, Chris. And Jim is in Manchester. Hi, Jim. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you. My question is a pretty simple one. If finally Donald Trump is not successful and is overcome by Cruz or whoever in the primary process, what is the likelihood of he deciding, despite his protestations, to run as an independent, and how will that affect things?
Okay, Jim, thank you. And I think, Dean, we'll throw that one to you again.
That's a great question. You know, Donald Trump had threatened early on to form a third-party bid. He certainly has the resources to fund it. He then kind of backtracked and pledged not to do so as long as the party treated him well. And we all kind of tried to read the tea leaves about what it meant to say the party treated him well. I think it would be unlikely. I mean, I suppose he could. I think he's pretty locked in now at this point. I think they believe that they can compete pretty solidly for some period of time. You know, we've heard Michael Bloomberg, the billionaire former mayor of New York City, say that he might get in if it turns out that Sanders and or Trump are the nominees. He said he would not be thrilled about that. He's looking at an independent run. So we may end up with this. It would be pretty amusing to have, you know, these two multi-billionaires dueling it out to be the independent candidate to go up against others. But I think it seems right now that Trump is pretty much all in, and Bloomberg will decide sometime by the end of March.
Speaking of money in politics, we all saw the ads here in New Hampshire over the past, well, year practically, but especially in the past month. And Casey McDermott, this came up this week in New Hampshire's race for U.S. Senate. Senator Kelly Ayotte, the sitting senator, being challenged by New Hampshire Governor Maggie Hassan. This week, Kelly Ayotte said to Governor Hassan, join me in signing the People's Pledge. What is this, Casey?
Right. So this was used actually in the 2012 Massachusetts Senate race between Elizabeth Warren and Scott Brown when he was running in Massachusetts at that time. And it basically proposes that the candidates agree to pay fines in the form of charitable donations when third party ads are aired in their favor. And it's used as a way to kind of tamp down on this kind of outside spending that we've seen a lot of.
Wow, that could be a lot of charitable donations.
Yeah,
this is a lot of money.
At the state level. And, you know, we've seen it in the presidential race, too, obviously. So Kelly Ayotte called on Maggie Hassan this week to join her in signing this pledge. This is something that I believe Jean Shaheen called on Scott Brown to do last year or the year before, and I don't think he took her up on that. And at this point, I think it's still developing because it only happened yesterday that Ayotte made this proposition. But at this time, I think Hassan has said she'd maybe like to make some changes to it, make some modifications before she agrees to anything. But Senator Ayotte did speak with Morning Edition on NHPR this morning and said that, you know, she thought that this was important to kind of, you know, if we're really serious about tamping down on outside influence, that this would be a way to show it.
So go ahead, Dean.
The interesting thing, and, you know, the Governor Hassan said they would consider this carefully. You know, some Democratic partisans are saying, you know, outside groups have already spent $5 million on Kelly Ayotte, including the Koch brothers, either some or all of that. Hassan, it's only been about $600,000. So, you know, some are suggesting that she's kind of using this to sort of move off of the fact that all that money has already been spent against Hassan. As Casey mentioned, it was used in Massachusetts, and it reduced outside spending by something like 90%. So it could, in theory, work if they agree. My guess is this is the kind of thing where they'll work out some sort of an agreement. But as we know, this is going to be an incredibly expensive U.S. Senate race.
Why would Gary, Senator Ayotte, want to shut off the availability of outside money for her own campaign?
Well, I think, you know, as we've seen, there's already been a couple million dollars dropped on Hassan's head. I mean, there's going to be a whole lot of money dropped on Kelly Ayotte's head coming down the road. And if she can divert some of this somewhere else and into some other election, then that's what she wants to do.
Casey?
I think it's also kind of a way to corner Governor Hassan in some way during her gubernatorial campaign. And also, you know, in the few months that she's been running for Senate, she has made a point of calling out kind of so-called special interests. She frequently mentions the Koch brothers, other outside spenders. So I think this was probably a way for Senator Ayotte and her campaign to kind of, you know, put pressure on Governor Hassan to say, if you believe these things, then you should act on it in this way.
One more political question for you folks that I have received so much contact from our listeners on, and I need your help figuring it out. Here's a tweet from Scott who says, please talk about the superdelegates, who they are, and implications for Sanders, Clinton, and New Hampshire. An email from Fran, a lot of Democrats are in a huff about delegates, and in particular the fact that Hillary Clinton ends up with more than Bernie because of the superdelegates. Fran says, we need a show explaining all the things about delegates. Here's another email from Lynn, who describes herself as a confused voter in Bedford. She says, would you please discuss the New Hampshire superdelegate system in one of your programs in the near future, its history, how it operates, the identities of New Hampshire's current superdelegates, and the steps necessary to abolish the system specifically, Lynn says. And I just got another one from Jordan in Auburn, who also wants to know about superdelegates. He says, how can we ever make a difference when people are disenfranchised, not only by money controlling politics, but the delegate system itself negating votes? So lots and lots of feedback. Now, Dean, we're heading into a break,
right,
but just very quickly remind us what a superdelegate is.
Well, a superdelegate, this is going to take more than a few seconds to explain, but it basically is a way in which the Democratic Party nationally can have party elites who are there to kind of help beat back the potential threat of any insurgent. I'll explain it a bit more after
the
break.
Sure. Do they do it on the Republican side, too?
No, they not anymore, no.
That's interesting. I did not know that. All right, all of you, we will figure it out after a short break and keep taking your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. It's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. The This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. There's a lot of news from the State House this week, and we'll follow up on that in just a moment, including a vote on Medicaid expansion and GMO food labeling. As always, you can join us. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests this week are Gary Reno, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News, Casey McDermott, digital reporter here at NHPR, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, just before the break, we were diving into what so many of our listeners want to know, how this whole superdelegate system works, and some frustration from folks who feel like, hey, Bernie Sanders got a giant margin over Hillary Clinton, and yet Secretary Clinton still has a fair number of superdelegates from the Granite State.
Yeah, and there was also a lot of frustration back in 2008, and I'll mention that in a moment. So superdelegates were designed by the Democratic Party in the early 1980s, around 1982, as a means of reasserting control over a largely decentralized selection process that's dominated by the campaigns and individual states. And so they came up with this idea of creating, it was roughly around 800 superdelegates, and these are kind of party elites or party muckety-mucks, elected officials, party elders, et cetera, who would have the opportunity as superdelegates to pledge for whichever candidate they would like. It's essentially a means of kind of putting your thumb on the scale or knocking back an insurgent threat by a candidate that the party deems as not in the party's interest. So there are, as I said, we're now down to about 712 of these. They've reduced the number a little bit, but they can basically pledge whomever they want. And the issue here with New Hampshire is New Hampshire had 24 delegates at stake in the Democratic primary. Bernie Sanders, by virtue of his victory in Democratic Party uses proportional assignment for their delegates, he gets 15 of the 24 delegates. But Hillary Clinton got 6 of the 8 superdelegates who live in New Hampshire to pledge to her, people like...
Before the election.
Gene Shaheen, Governor Hassan, Congresswoman Custer. So in the end, when you add in the superdelegates, it's a 15-15 delegate split, even though she lost by 22%.
So that doesn't sit right with folks.
Well, here's the issue, and this happened in 2008. The concern is that it gives the party an opportunity to take the nominee away from whichever candidate gets the most votes through the regular process. So in 2008, as it was clear that Barack Obama was leading, there was some concern that these superdelegates were going to pledge for Hillary Clinton and essentially take the nomination away from Barack Obama. And then it got very ugly with racial implications that they would be taking the nomination away from the first African-American nominee, et cetera. So in the end, the superdelegates said, all right, we're going to be neutral. We will abide by whatever the final result is. And we're already seeing petition drives among Sanders supporters at MoveOn.org for the same sort of thing, to tell the superdelegates either wait and see who has the most delegates and go with them, or go the way that your individual state goes.
Do you guys want to jump in on this? This is very interesting. And Casey, it's kind of a civics lesson for people. And like I said, I can't tell you how many emails, phone calls, tweets we've gotten from listeners over the past couple days.
Yeah, it really is. I think just as Dean mentioned, there is a petition, one of which is through MoveOn.org. I'm looking at one right now, and it currently has 15,928 signatures calling on those superdelegates who have committed to Clinton to kind of, you know, go with the will of the people, so to speak. So I would expect that would rise, because those signatures have come together fairly quickly over the last few days. And it's also, I think it's worth noting that there are two superdelegates, who have not yet committed, one of which is Senator Martha Fuller Clark of Portsmouth. The other is State Party Chairman Ray Buckley, who can't pick a candidate during the primaries. This is according to a report in the Concord Monitor by Megan Doyle. But I think it will be interesting just to see both, you know, how this plays out in general, but also what kind of pushback some of these state leaders and elected officials might get, just based on kind of people being discontent with them not going with how the popular vote shook out.
Gary?
And there's nothing that says that these people have to vote for.
Yeah, they can flip.
They can do whatever they want. And traditionally in New Hampshire, they've always had a unified front. So, I mean, if it comes down to the, you know, I got a call from my sister-in-law last night, just who's a very big Bernie supporter, and she was all upset about this. And I said, well, you can't say that it's unfair until you get to the convention and you see what these people
do. They don't actually vote till the
convention. So you can't say that it's unfair, that it's taken away from Bernie Sanders.
But, Gary, you probably remember the Obama-Clinton battle.
Oh, it was ugly.
Yes, in 2008.
But it does seem old-fashioned, right? I mean, you know, the way we used to do it back when the country was formed. And, you know, some of our founding fathers were worried about the will of the masses. But now, I mean, this is a democracy. Yeah. I vote. Mm-hmm. It should count. So I understand, Gary, why it's got so many people upset.
Oh, I know. But it's just that I think people are jumping to conclusions. That's all.
Okay.
You know, that's all.
But for now, she has 360 of these pledged.
Around
Sanders has 8. Yeah. So right now it's making people uncomfortable because it gives her a lead, even though he tied her in essentially in Iowa and had won big in New Hampshire. Yeah. So, yeah, I understand why people are upset.
Casey?
Well, I think there's been a long running theme throughout a lot of discussions, particularly on the Democratic side, that there's somehow some kind of rigged game in favor of Hillary Clinton. We saw that with the debate over the debates on that side, as well as some other things. So I think that this kind of falls into that existing kind of subtext that, you know, is really kind of getting a lot of people, particularly who back Senator Sanders and who think that he's this, you know, insurgent who is being kind of tamped down by the party leaders. This feeds into that narrative.
Okay, last question on this. Dean, I'm struck by what you said, that Republicans don't do this.
Well, they did at one point. They were called unpledged delegates. But as we're seeing, it causes so much controversy that they basically have moved away from it. And, you know, we'll see. There may be at some point a move to do away with this as well, because now this is twice. Every time there's an open seat on the Democratic side, it just causes a lot of hard feelings.
All right. Let's go back to our listeners. Again, it's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. And what a week in the Granite State. Covering the news, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And all of you, let's go to Ron in Concord. Hi, Ron. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, Laura. Good morning, guest.
Morning.
I was just wondering if your guests have an opinion on how the political establishment endorsements and the somewhat incongruous primary results, especially on the Democratic side, may spill over into subsequent statewide elections.
Yeah, we were talking about that earlier, Ron. Thank you so much. What do you think, Gary?
I think it will. You know, there's a certain element that's going to have an effect. But statewide elections are, I mean, they're always a little more open than you would think of as the presidential elections. I mean, people are going to get into the race because they're going to get into the race because they want to, not because the party tells them they can or they can't. So in that respect, I think that's not going to have much of an effect. I think what it's going to do is it's going to make it wide open, though. We're going to see a lot more people running than we might have seen if we didn't have this sort of turnout the way we did.
All right. Let's turn to the State House, because there was a lot happening there that we do need to catch up on. And Casey McDermott, to you first, please. The House took a major step this week toward Medicaid expansion, voting to approve HB 1696. The margin was 207 to 136. So reasonable, but not huge. What's different about this Medicaid approach, Casey, versus the system that we're operating under now?
Right. So this program would set up kind of a new funding mechanism where hospitals and insurers would be asked to chip in basically the state's share of it starting in 2017. It's important to keep in mind that right now the federal government foots the bill for the full cost of covering people through the program. But starting in 2017, that's going to incrementally decrease and the state's going to have to come up with the difference. So that's been kind of a central question as we inch toward whether to reauthorize it or not, is if we do reauthorize it, how is the state going to pay for it? So there's that. There's also a work requirement that is incorporated in there that would require people to provide kind of proof that they are working or engaging in some kind of education, training opportunities, things like that, as well as a few other kind of changes. So it's not going to be exactly the same. It's going to be pretty similar, but there are going to be some changes.
So covering the same population, mm-hmm. these are the folks who aren't covered under traditional Medicaid, but are very low income adults, whether they're working or not. Now there's this work requirement. I was really interested when I first started hearing about this, Casey, about the funding. Kind of surprised that the hospitals would say, sure, we'll chip in.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, I think it's still, you know, there's going to be a long discussion in the legislature before this is ultimately approved. But I think the way that it's been framed is that these health providers do pick up some benefits by having people covered, having them engaged in more regular medical care. So it is to some extent an investment for them to contribute to the ongoing, you know, sustainability of this program.
And the federal government is still, Gary, picking up 90%. So they're chipping in a little, but they're definitely not paying full freight, so to speak.
And I mean, if you look at it in terms of the money involved, you know, the state's going to have to pay about $40 million, something in that ballpark, of which the hospitals and the insurance company is going to pay $32 million. For that $32 million, there's a $500 million coming into the state. I mean, it's a very good investment for them. And in fact, the money that's coming from the hospitals and the insurance companies is in these funds. If we remember the JUA controversy a while ago, this fund that was put in for the insurance coverage for, well, there's other funds like that that are being tapped for this money.
Well, it is interesting, though, Gary, given the, and you're hinting at this, the push-pull between hospitals and insurers and the state and the various taxes and money sort of being shifted back and forth. So, again, kind of remarkable that everybody's playing ball at this point.
Oh, well, they are. But, I mean, the prize is the $500 million that it's coming
from the federal government
that's coming into the state. So, I mean, it's well worth the investment on these people's part.
Well, and Dean, you know, a lot of support for this out in the broader political community, the Business and Industry Association, the hospitals, you know, substance abuse providers. Democrats, of course, are all on board on this. Strong support among Republicans in the Senate. So what was the concern in the House? As I said, 136 members were opposed.
Yeah, well, you know, I think the concern for some people continues to be cost. If you go back to the original, you know, debate around this program when it was first expanded, there was a lot of concern about the creation of unfunded mandates and whether or not this would end up being a financial burden on state budgets. They wanted some of these additional requirements that you mentioned put in, like the work requirements, but they're going to need federal waivers for those. So we'll see. We'll see how that goes. And, you know, there's co-pays now for unnecessary ER visits, which has always been kind of a bone of contention when we talk about healthcare coverage. So it feels to me like, you know, sort of every step of the way, you know, the Republicans have been able to sort of shape the program in a little bit differently than it's been shaped in some other states where it's just basically a pure federal program. And I think what we're seeing coming out of the House, and you know, my guess is the governor is probably favorably disposed, continues that with bringing insurance companies, hospitals kicking in, et cetera, in a way that kind of allows the program to go forward but keeps some of the spirit of the impact that Republicans had on it when it was initially drafted.
Casey?
One other important change that I should point out is that the Republican-backed proposal would include another kind of sunset at the end of 2018. Right. So the discussion that we're having right now could very well come up again in 2 years. Their legislation also includes the creation of a kind of commission or committee to study the effectiveness of the program to make kind of recommendations about whether it should continue. A largely Democratic-backed proposal that would make little to no changes to the existing program would make it basically permanent. So,
one more question about this for you, Casey. Supporters of expanded Medicaid are tying it to the state's substance abuse crisis. What's the connection, Casey?
Right. So the Medicaid expansion did offer substance abuse coverage for the newly covered population. And during the one of the hearings on the proposal to extend it a few weeks ago, we heard from a few different people who were able to get coverage through the program who had not been able to before. So given the kind of urgency of the substance abuse crisis here, I think you'll continue to see people kind of circle back to that as, okay, here's another way that we could fight this if we continue the program.
Gary?
I mean, Governor Passan has maintained right along that we need this money to entice these people to keep coming, to expand in New Hampshire or to come to New Hampshire for these treatment programs. And without this guarantee of federal funds, she's saying that it's unlikely that they'll come here and or that it will expand here. And so that's her big push for this.
Again, our phone number on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Join us as we talk about some of the top headlines around New Hampshire this week with Gary Reno, Casey McDermott, and Dean Spiliotis. You can join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, find us on Facebook or Twitter. So the Medicaid expansion was a big vote in support. Another vote in support this week, Casey, was on Real ID. Now, this has been a long story here in New Hampshire and around the country. Just back up, please, and just remind us what this is all about. This stems from, you know, 9/11 and security concerns.
Right. So the Real ID program would basically require certain information to be included on New Hampshire licenses. New Hampshire legislators were reticent to or resistant to the idea of adding this information. I believe a lot of the concerns stem from privacy concerns, certain information that would be collected or distributed. So this week, there was a compromise that was put forward that I think, you know, the way that it's being framed is it would allow New Hampshire to go forward with it and people would be able to opt in to Real ID instead of being required to get these new IDs that would include that information.
So what's the benefit, Gary?
Well, the benefit
of this
is
compromise. Yeah.
Well, what's happening now, why it's urgent at this point, is because some of this stuff is starting to kick in. And you can't get into federal buildings now without a compliant ID. You can't get into federal facilities without a compliant ID. You can't even get into BAE Systems facility because they do government work without a compliant ID. And starting in January 2018, you can't go through an airport without one of these unless you have a passport or you're willing to subject yourself to enhanced security check. So that's why the urgency right now.
So things are going to get more difficult for folks who don't have
these
so-called
Real IDs.
They're going
to be much more difficult as time goes on.
Yeah, that's the push. Yeah, Dean.
This is one of those classic libertarian arguments about privacy rights, and people who oppose this don't like the idea of the federal government essentially being able to track you through the information included on this enhanced ID. I believe we're one of a very small number of states, four or six, who are in this position currently, and so that's one of the reasons why they're trying to work towards a compromise. The government has, I think, at some point pushed back a little bit the ability to continue to use what you have for a little while longer, but at some point it may become a problem.
Yeah, we've gotten lots of extensions,
yes,
haven't we, Dean, since 9/11?
Yep.
Because, again, this was put in pretty quickly after after the attacks.
And if this goes through and gets passed in some way, shape, or form, we'd have like a 5-year window to get everything caught up.
To the driver's
license.
So opt in. You don't have to get one of these,
no,
but you can. So, Casey, as long as somebody stays away from flying and federal buildings and working at BAE and other government contractors, you could have, you know, the usual old New Hampshire ID without the security checks and all that that's involved.
Yeah, that's my understanding. And that was really, you know, again, just to reiterate, I think that's the kind of the crux of this is that people don't want to be forced to adopt this if they don't want to. But if they do want to be able to go on to, you know, go through these certain security clearances, then the option does exist for people who live in New Hampshire to be able to do that without having to get a passport or some kind of additional identification.
The crucial issue is what gets saved by the Department of Motor Vehicles in terms of the information. You know, you can opt out so that there's no information to say, you know, your social security number and all that stuff is not saved by the state. And when you have the compliant ID, it is. And then the difference that's let it go as far as it has in New Hampshire is there's no longer a federal database. It would still be a state database. It would be able to access by the federal authorities, but it would not be done by the federal government. That's
right.
What's cleared this a little bit.
Well, it's really interesting to see what's going to happen here in New Hampshire. And I wonder what other transportation companies like buses and trains will do, you know, now that you'll have to have one of these to get on a plane. I wonder if they'll take that extra step. We will talk more after a short break, follow up on a couple more bills in the legislature, including one to require labeling foods that contain genetically modified ingredients. That bill was shot down. We'll find out more in just a minute. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. We're catching up on some of the top Granite State headlines of the week, and you can join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. One more time, that exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 6477. This week, our guests are Gary Reno, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News, Casey McDermott, digital reporter with us here at NHPR, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the Schools of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And a couple more efforts at the State House that I did want to catch up on with all of you. And then I did want to turn to a story about maple syrup season and also a farm animal that made an appearance at a polling place this week. But first, Gary Reno, GMOs, an effort to require labeling foods that contain genetically modified ingredients, known as GMOs, again, similar to what is done in Vermont. This bill would not have banned these ingredients in our food supply. No. It would have labeled them. How would this have worked, Gary?
Well, it would have required that food processors would have labeled, when they have the labels on their food, it would have to say that it was genetically altered food. And that's, I mean, it's the same thing as Vermont has done and Maine and most other New England states. We can talk about Medicaid expansion and all that, but there's nothing that seems to turn people out any more than this GMO bill. Every time they have it, it just goes forever and just huge crowds. And, I mean, one person called it the people's right to know on the label, and the other, it's a similar argument to the federal government, to local control and all, you know, and the people who are opposed to this are all saying, well, this needs to be a federal issue because otherwise companies will be writing labels for three states here and four states there. And so what we need is a federal solution, not a local solution.
Well, the companies see it as a cost issue. They don't want to have to do exactly what you described, have these different labels for different states. It's just very complicated, particularly for things that are produced at a higher volume.
So that's what opponents said, Dean, is, look, this is just too much trouble state by state.
It should be a federal solution. Well, just in general, I think they find the whole labeling. I mean, they've dealt with over the years, a lot of producers have dealt with, changing label standards from the federal government. And so you hear a lot of this. I hear a lot of the same sort of cost arguments about this is just going to be another burden, particularly because it's sort of uneven between New Hampshire and elsewhere.
Although, Gary, does that sort of it's too troublesome to do it state by state go away when you look at Vermont has this and Maine has this? So why not New Hampshire?
Vermont is in the middle of a lot of litigation over the whole issue. So then that was another thing that people were saying here. Well, we don't want to get into all this litigation. Why do we want to do that?
OK, so the GMO food labeling bill just went down this week, basically.
By a fairly large number.
Another bill that was rejected, I'll turn to you, Casey, on this, was the House rejected increased funding for districts that adopt full-day kindergarten. So what was this all about, Casey?
Right. So this wouldn't have mandated districts to adopt full-day kindergarten. It just would have kind of adjusted the formula used to fund them. So the vote was rejected, 157-200 along party lines. And this was after, I believe, a committee had voted in favor of this recommendations. But once it got to the full House, it was shot down. And right now, the state provides adequacy funding for half-day kindergarten programs, but not for full-day kindergarten programs. But like I said, this would kind of use kind of average pupils per day, I think, as a formula to determine how the state could start to provide funding for these programs.
I mean, the state only pays half of what you would get per pupil in the adequate education aid for kindergarten, even if you have a full day. And this would have brought it up to the full. If you have a full day, you would have gotten the full.
For those districts that provide it.
Which is about $3,500 per student. The cost was the big issue here, which is like $13 million.
Which would have been a big incentive, Dean, for those districts that only have half to bump it up to full if they were getting that full adequacy grant from the state.
Yeah, it's amazing how long this issue has been at play in the state. When I first moved here, I remember hearing discussions about full-day kindergarten versus statewide or not, or half-day. And I was interested to learn there are 180 districts in the state who have a full-day kindergarten. That's an interesting number to know.
180? Well,
180
that's a
districts,
lot.
Yep.
Out of 230-something.
Okay, right.
Yep. Right. Wow. Well, and Concord, the capital city, does not have full-day kindergarten. So, all right. Well, setting that one aside, for the moment, that funding's rejected, although the debate will probably come back, as so many do in the legislature, right, Gary? The same bills come up and up and up. Another one that comes up year after year, Gary, is efforts to legalize marijuana. There was a bill to both legalize it, regulate it, and tax it. So the state could get a little bit of money from that. The House voted it down. Any surprises there, Gary? The House in general has been more favorable to marijuana legislation.
They have been. And I mean, it was a well-thought-out bill. And, you know, a lot of these are sort of thrown together. And this one had a lot of work put into it. But it just, it's not that it's an election year and nobody's going to be voting for legalizing marijuana or coming into an election, general election. And I mean, there are a lot of issues with it. It allowed for basically six plants, which is like 3 pounds of marijuana. And I mean, some people were saying, well, why are people going to buy it and pay the tax when you can grow it on your own and not pay it? I mean, there are things like that that brought it out. And it went down fairly largely. I mean, we have yet to come up with the decriminalization of marijuana bill.
Right.
So that's still out there.
Which is usually, I mean, it's usually sails through the House, decriminalization, and stalls in the Senate. I mean, this one is dead on arrival at the Senate anyway.
Our phone number again for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Join us as we cover some of the top Granite State headlines of the week on our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. So, Dean, I'm going to turn to you first on this next one. Very complicated, but very interesting. A bill for a road usage fee. Again, it's complicated, but it's interesting because it's part of a broader debate over how we fund transportation in an era when cars are becoming more fuel efficient. So they're just paying less in gas taxes, which is levied by the gallon. So just give us your overall take, Dean, on this road usage fee.
And my understanding was it was defeated, correct?
Right.
Right,
polite
which sort of
death. What Gary calls a polite death.
Gary calls that a polite death, right? Sorry, excuse me, it is polite death. Yeah, as you mentioned, you know, this is the ongoing issue of dealing with, you know, crumbling state infrastructure, roads and bridges, and figuring out, as you mentioned, in an age of fuel efficient vehicles, how to kind of fairly tax people for usage of the road. And we think about that gas tax that took us 20 years to move the gas tax
four cents.
So I'm not surprised to hear that. But I think it's probably not the last time, given the conditions of our roads, that the legislature is going to grapple with, you know, how to sort of make the system more fair so that people pay for usage of the road and the wear and the tear.
Interestingly enough, while they were sending this to a polite death, they passed a bill which would require electric car owners to prepay their road toll quota or gas tax up front.
That did pass, Gary?
That did pass. It's a preliminary pass. It went to the House Ways and Means, but it'll be coming back before the House. But basically it would charge, if whatever you pay for your registration, you're going to be paying in road tolls. It was something that was in place about 10 years ago but was repealed. So this went forward in the House while they sent this one to a polite death.
Casey, this is tough because, you know, everybody wants to raise money for the roads. On the other hand, people with fuel-efficient vehicles say, look, I'm helping you out. I'm not spewing out carbon. So why should I be penalized?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's certainly something that's come up around that discussion. But again, you know, as was mentioned, there is this kind of, you know, ongoing question of how do we make sure that we're taking care of our infrastructure. And this is something that has come up in the presidential campaign as well. You hear Bernie Sanders talk a lot about it, because there are these outstanding projects and these kind of, you know, crumbling roads, bridges, things like that, that do need to be funded and fixed in some way. So there's kind of this big question mark as far as how you actually do that.
Yeah, and what is the fair share, quote unquote, and who should pay it? Absolutely, Gary.
Fairness is in the eye of the beholder.
Right. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. All right. Well, turning to something a little lighter. Maple syrup season, Casey McDermott, and it's really cold today, and it's going to be very cold this weekend. But from what I've read, the maple syrup season is kind of messed up because warmer temperatures earlier this winter started things going, and then it got cold. And can you just update us there, please?
Yeah, the union leader had a story this week on this, that there are some maple syrup producers who are actually starting about a month earlier than usual.
Wow.
This year. Some have been boiling as early as January 10th. The season really, as you said, has been kind of all over the place. I think that it doesn't really take, you know, a meteorologist or anyone with kind of an advanced scientific degree to tell you that the weather's been all over the place in New Hampshire for the last few winters. So that certainly would have an effect on the trees that produce this syrup.
Yeah, well, and I wonder how, you know, what's going to happen now with the cold weekend, Gary. You're a longtime New Hampshire guy. I mean, can you enlighten us on this? Yeah, I remember being out in, you know, with no coat in January, and now it's quite cold.
It will bring a halt to the sap flow, obviously, the cold weather will, because you need the warm days above the freezing point to bring it up through the trees. So, but it won't, I mean, it's not going to harm anything. It will just delay it for a while.
Two more stories that I did want to follow up on with all of you. And Gary, I know you want to talk about this one, so I'll give it to you first. A polling station in southern New Hampshire had an unusual visitor this election week.
Well, yes, it was a 600-pound pig running around in Pelham voting polls.
Snorting at politics.
Snorting at politics and people and whatever. I guess it was a local farmer. The pig got out from a local farm. But all I could think of was this must be the reincarnation of Pigasus. And I'm getting dated here. But in 1968, if we remember the Yippie Party, Jerry Rubens and Abby Hoffman ran a pig for president. Pigasus.
But, I did not know that.
Well, and it's funny because, as was true for some voters, if I had encountered this, I would have thought somebody was making a political statement of some sort, right?
This is
political pork earmarks, et cetera. No, it was just a pig that wandered off of a farm. I have to tell listeners, if you want to have a good chuckle, there's video of this on the web. And if it's possible for a pig to look irritated, this pig looks really annoyed. And he or she is basically chasing.
He doesn't know who to vote for.
Yeah, he's basically chasing cops around the cop cars. It's hilarious. My wife and I were just chuckling this morning pig chase people around the cop car.
Well, after a long election season, we could all use a good laugh. So I will look that up, Dean. That is great. Well, and the city of Dover, Dean, this week taking a stand against electronic cigarettes, which have grown wildly popular here in the Granite State. Just in Concord, we've gone from, zero e-cigarette shops to, three or four. Lots of convenience stores sell these and so forth. But the city of Dover is saying, we don't like this.
Yeah, they've basically, the city council basically unanimously voted to ban the use of these e-cigarettes, or sometimes it's called vaping, from places where tobacco is already banned. So if there's some place that you can't smoke a cigarette, you can't, quote, vape there either. And it's like a $50 fine the first time and $100 for a subsequent fine. These have become a popular way. People who use them believe it's a healthier, relatively speaking, a healthier alternative to using traditional tobacco products. But there is sort of a popular, just like with cigarettes, there's a whole culture and ambiance around the use of these things. As you said, we have at least one big parlor on Main Street in Concord, and there are other ones as well. You see them all over the place. I see on campus at SNHU, I see some students using them outdoors. And so for Dover, this sort of changes things a little bit.
Gary, do you expect other cities to follow Dover's suit? If you can't smoke in a restaurant or smoke at a playground, you can't vape either.
I imagine, there'll certainly be, I would assume Portsmouth might be another one who would consider this and various other places. I mean, we have people standing, if you will, free staters who are at some of these hearings are standing there with their e-cigarettes in them. You can't smoke in the state house anywhere. Or the legislative office building, but there are people sitting there vaping, as they say. Yeah,
which produces a tremendous amount of water vapor, basically.
So I can't imagine that this is going to not be touched in some way or another.
Okay. Well, all of you, we always like to close out the show looking ahead to next week and what you'll be covering. And Casey McDermott, will you be taking a break next week after the election, or will you be out there covering the news?
I'll be using the long weekend to do that, but I will definitely be back to work. I will be sleeping a lot, but I think that it's going to be interesting just to see how the gubernatorial race and the Senate race and other kind of local level races start to heat up. As we discussed at the beginning of the show, obviously Senator Ayotte and Governor Hassan are really going to jump into things, already have this week. And I think that, the New Hampshire politics scene doesn't look like it's going to kind of quiet down anytime soon now that the primary has moved on.
There was news, I think, in the Union Leader this morning about Ted Gatsis, mayor of Manchester, considering a gubernatorial run. Did you see that, Casey?
I've seen reports of that. I've seen reports of some other people looking to jump in, maybe on the Democratic side or the Republican side. So I would be surprised if the field as it is now stays, settled and we don't see other people kind of put their names in as well.
Okay, so for those of you who are sorry that the presidential primary is over, you've got a gubernatorial race to look forward to and a pretty hot U.S. Senate race.
And I think, too, it will be interesting. I think this election may have some effect on that. We'll see more people jump into the governor's race in particular. Probably the U.S. Senate race is pretty well set.
Sure.
But the governor's race, we're talking about Ted Gatsis And there's also talk about Andy Samben thinking about running, too. And on the Democratic side, everybody's waiting to see what Stephanie Shaheen's going to do. It's going to probably be a lot larger field than it is right now.
So we'll have some real primaries.
We should have some real primaries
both sides. Right. Yeah. What about Congressman Frank Ginta in the 1st Congressional District, Gary? I know he's running for re-election.
Mm-hmm.
But has he faced any challengers, given that he had some real troubles with the Federal Election Commission?
Yeah, Don Innes, who was ran against him the last time, is going to be running again.
Dan Innes, former dean of the business school at UNH.
And he's going to have some, there are two Democrats who have already said that they're going to go, Carol Shea Porter, who has held a seat for a while before, and
Sean O'Connor
from Bedford, who is also talking about, well, he's also gotten into the Democratic race.
Big votes at the State House this week, Gary, for you to cover.
Well, it's actually kind of quieter. It's a little quieter at the State House this week. This week was a bad week because it's the deadline for getting bills that have to go to a second committee done.
I see.
So next week is a little quieter. The House isn't even meeting in session next week. They're going to take 2 weeks off because they have the end of the February off. They're not coming back till March. But we have a lot of committee meetings going on all week long.
Just in case you have
nothing else to do.
Do.
Right.
Okay. Dean, how about you? What will you be watching next week?
Obviously continue to keep watching the presidential race from afar and thinking about whether it may come back around at some point if New Hampshire in the general election plays a swing state role as it has in some other recent elections. But like a lot of other political observers, I'm looking forward to shifting my attention to these statewide races, which I think are going to be incredibly interesting and very competitive.
All right. All of you, thank you so much. Gary Reno, thank you for being here.
Great to be here, Laura.
Gary Reno, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. Casey McDermott, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Casey McDermott, digital reporter for us here at NHPR. Dean Spiliotis, always good to see you. Thank you so much.
Sure thing, Laura.
Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producer is Faith Meixel with help from Jessica Hunt. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Knoy.